Hello everyone, welcome back to Millennial 2019. I'm going to keep my camera off for this stream because Blackpilled, my guest, his internet access isn't great, his connection speed isn't great, so it might be less onerous on the connection if I don't use video. So, Blackpilled was on last year as well. He is, I think most of you will be aware of who he is, but he has a YouTube channel in which he mostly, well, why don't you introduce yourself to people, Blackpilled? And welcome to Millennial.
Well, thanks for having me on. If you're not familiar with my channel, I think a lot of people would say most of what I do is analyze propaganda, analyze media, and kind of the messaging that's been inserted, and sometimes is the entire point of a lot of movies and television and music. But that's not all I do. I also do, and I'm going to be doing next year a lot more, talking about my homestead that I'm doing, and just like regular streams, kind of commentary about, about media and about the propaganda and culture that we're trying to shape instead of relying on the culture that's manufactured for us.
Right. Okay. And we're going to speak about that later on. But in the meantime, what would you say about 2019, this year, and the development of things throughout this year?
2019, I would say, I wish I could go back and look at my channel and see where my head was at, because I know that at a certain point in time in 2019, I still kind of had at least a little bit of hope maybe that Trump was going to come through on at least some of the bigger promises that he's kind of fallen short on. And but certainly by the end of 2019 now, I'm convinced that's not really the case. I don't see, the wall, for example. There's no wall. There's no lock her up. There's none of this, and there seems to be an awful lot of, for example, the executive order he did on anti-Semitism. It kind of proves that all these people, all these voices saying, "Oh, well, he can't do an executive order." That would make him look like a dictator. They would totally, the media would burn them alive, and metaphorically, of course, and it kind of proves all that to be false. Obviously, they're not going to go against a anti-Semitism executive order, you could say, but at the same time, it shows that he has the ability to do these things by executive order and just hasn't. And it's kind of like with Boris, who just gets elected and he promises, "Oh, we're going to have Brexit done by the end of January," and the first thing he does with his majority is a very similar piece of legislation, trying to fight this BDS movement, which, quite frankly, I don't think anyone cares about in the UK or in the United States. So it's a little puzzling that, I'm sure a really small minority cares about it, but it's still puzzling that would be the first order of business for Boris. And also, in many ways, there was a similar anti-BDS legislation passed. I want to say one of the first things that after the midterm elections in the United States, I think the first thing that Nancy Pelosi, and the only thing maybe that Nancy Pelosi and the Republicans collaborated on and actually pushed through, was another bit of anti-BDS legislation. So it's just kind of, it's once you see that's kind of what's going on, and all these nationalist leaders around the world that, a lot of people looked as, the rise of populism, finally, we're going to start having our voices heard. And you realize that a lot of these guys are Zionists, and it's a little frustrating. But at the same time, I think that by doing this kind of a thing, a lot of these people that might have called you a conspiracy theory or theorist by mentioning foreign influence in the West, are it's getting harder and harder and harder for them to do that, because it just seems like it's so obvious at this point that it's difficult to just explain away.
Yes, it's indeed. I'm not sure how much to get into this because the various laws and, of course, the climate on YouTube. But, yeah, in Britain, we've seen this recently with Jeremy Corbyn as well, who was really just demonized, not for hating Britain, but for not loving Israel enough, which is really, that is an obvious choice there. Which is more relevant to the British people? Which is more important to us in this election? And yet it was not really mentioned that he hated Britain, but he does. But the only thing the media wanted to talk about really was that he was anti-Semitic, even though I don't think he is. I think he's just, he's pro the underdog no matter what, in any conflict, sort of pathological altruism. And so, well, that means that, there are certain interests that you're going to oppose just on the basis that they're in charge. It's right. Sort of a classic leftist thing. But yeah, anyway, to move on from that, are there any other observations you want to make about 2019 and, you know, the events of this year?
Well, for me personally, there was a lot of changes. I went from a apartment in a city next to a lot of really loud downtown bars and that kind of a thing, where if I went out at after dark, I was in danger of being run over by a drunk driver or running over a drunk stumbling around in my neighborhood. I got out of the city and I've been, I don't even know what to call it, I guess resurrecting a very old and very, well, kind of a piece of shit house, basically, that I call the bunker. So for me personally, a lot of things have changed just in terms of just, you know, trying to get my show working on the air. You mentioned the internet problem. You know, that's been kind of a struggle. And having air conditioning and power and hot water, which is a new addition, which is pretty exciting because it's winter, and taking showers without hot water is kind of, it's unpleasant. This year has been a lot of changes for me personally. In terms of the country, I don't think a whole lot has changed. I think people are just noticing the realities more. I don't think that fundamentally, like, for example, I don't think Trump, you know, just as an example, I don't think Trump has shifted course. You know, I don't think 2016 Trump really is any different than 2019 Trump. I just think that people are seeing clearer that rather than projecting their hopes and, you know, because I feel like a lot of what propelled Trump into office is a lot of people are panicking and starting to think that, you know, we're on the brink if we don't get, you know, we've been asking for immigration reform and we've been asking for a wall or some kind of enforcement, just something for as long as I've been alive. Honestly, this has been an issue. And if we don't get this under control now, we're going to lose the political power to be able to do that. And so Trump was saying the right things. But there were warning signs even in 2015, 2016 that I think a lot of people glossed over because he, you know, he was saying like, oh, we're going to build the wall. And but at the same time, he was saying that he wanted to let people into the country and that he wanted a big, beautiful door in the wall. And that he didn't want to, like, there, I remember there was actually he was doing an interview with Sean Hannity. It was like a town hall kind of a thing. And an old guy in the audience was like, hey, look, we got to get rid of all these anchor babies and stuff. And Trump was like, oh, no, well, we can't. I mean, these are good people. We can't just throw them out. So there were warning signs early on. And, and of course, in terms of the foreign influence sort of a thing, that obviously it's not like his daughter just married Jared Kushner. You know, like those connections have always been there. The people that have granted him loans in the past for decades for him to be a real estate mogul. You know, a lot of these connections are old connections. The Adelson was funding his campaign. The inaugural committee was vastly overrepresented by a certain group. So, I mean, these weren't like, it's just that I think so many people were so excited that Well, that Hillary too was defeated. Because that was the big thing for me. Is like I almost would have voted for Obama again instead, just to get rid, not to have Hillary. And I think that people were so elated that the media, which I think a lot of us have always seen as kind of an enemy, that they were so wrong about the election. They were, you know, they were so devastated. The crying faces at Hillary's event on election night, the fact that she was probably too drunk to even go out and concede, the fact that Trump is funny and entertaining and says all these things that a lot of the right-wing candidates in the past have been so afraid of being called racist. Well, I mean, I don't know. Sometimes I wonder if that's just an excuse that's used and they're really on the same team. But he was still, you know, he was calling them fake news. It was exciting. It was fun. And there was a lot of energy because we thought that, you know, finally we're going to be heard because we've had this city thousands of miles away in the richest, well, actually, I think like the four richest counties in America are like all around D.C., ruling us from afar and not doing anything that we need done, but instead deferring to the whims of the military industrial complex and other moneyed interests. And I don't think that Trump was ever that guy.
You said that you'd rather have another 4 years of Obama rather than Hillary.
Right.
Do you still feel like that? Do you still feel that Hillary would have been abominable? Yeah. Right. Worse than Trump or what?
Yeah, absolutely. I think Trump, I mean, there's, you know, sometimes people are like, oh, well, if Hillary had won, you know, the accelerationist argument, right? That if Hillary would have won, then people would have woken up. I don't think so. I think Trump isn't like I don't even think Trump's a net loss. I think he did a lot of good in terms of, you know, I mean, think about it. Even boomers who have grown up believing everything their TV has told them. I mean, boomers who have been the reason that when you go to the supermarket, the National Enquirer and stuff like, you know, I remember a woman or a teacher of mine when I was a kid saying, well, they couldn't print it if it wasn't true. You know, like this generation that just eats up whatever the media is feeding them. He turned them against the media 100% by doing the fake news. Cause it turns out boomers love Trump more than they believe the media. And so, or they believe Trump.
That does seem to be a change that has happened across the board. That the faith that people had in the media has been really smashed in America by the Trump thing and in Britain by the Brexit thing.
Absolutely destroyed. And I think that a large part of that's Trump. But another part of it is just they've been overplaying their hand and just being really obvious about it in the last, I'd say, decade or so. But if Hillary had been elected, I mean, who's to say that some of us wouldn't have been put in jail? Maybe the censorship would have been cranked up. I mean, Trump's not stopping the censorship, but the censorship potentially, I mean, we'll never know, could have accelerated under Hillary. And then a lot of these ideas that are, I mean, we're still just now reaching, there's certain people that, I mean, for us, it's kind of old hat, but there's a lot of these ideas that we're still, that, you know, sometimes seem repetitive that are just now reaching new people. And if Hillary had been elected, I think that would have been a green light to a lot of these companies that, you know, while Trump's not necessarily preventing censorship on these media platforms, they don't feel like they have a green light to just go as far as they'd like, as fast as they would like. Now, that might change because the election season of 2020. And I think we're already seeing a little bit of that. But I think we would have been headed, you know, further down the road, you know, and, which I think this is still way down the road, but I think it's down the road, but we'd be further down the road towards a Chinese style social credit system if Hillary had been elected. It also kind of sets the tone, you know, like it's by having Trump in office, it kind of communicates to the country that there's still a majority of people, you know, even though he lost the popular vote or whatever, you can say there's still a lot of people, for example, that still do. I mean, even whether he's doing it or not doesn't matter. There's a lot of people that want immigration reform. There's a lot of people that don't want these foreign wars. There's a lot of people that want all the things that he ran on, and which I think honestly was a big shock to the intelligentsia, you know, the media intelligentsia and the elites in Manhattan and in LA and DC. I remember actually it was during the 2000. I went to a. It was a 2000. It was 2016, I think, or it might have been late 2015. I went to some libertarian conference thing that because it was tied to some of the work I was doing, and I hadn't been in DC. I hadn't been in the city for, you know, maybe a couple of years or so. And as soon as I got off the plane, just in the airport, walking to get on the metro, I heard so many people talking about Trump, like scared. Like it was almost kind of what got me interested in Trump, because I hadn't really paid too much attention to him. But I heard like everywhere I went, like just, you know, people having conversations at the airport bar, people on the train, like, oh, Trump's going to be a disaster. And the more like I heard this stuff, I was like, I kind of like this guy now. And that's actually in my hotel room that's when I listened to my first or watched my first Trump rally stream. It was like one of these what is it, the red, what's that, the YouTube channel that was streaming? Oh, it doesn't matter. There was a YouTube channel that streamed all the Trump rallies, and I watched it.
Oh yeah, it's Red, White, and Blue, wasn't it, or something like that?
Red something, like Red, I don't know. They're still around, just like no one no, it's what Nick Fuentes used to work for him, like briefly, until they found out certain things about him. But at any rate, I watched that and was like, I knew immediately he was going to win, because, you know, like I don't want to say I'm like this propaganda expert, but I am, like, that's what I've been doing for at least a decade. And he was saying all the right things. He was getting people to think emotionally, and that's something that Hillary was incapable of doing. And most of the Republicans were incapable of doing. I mean, even the people like that you thought might have had a more of a chance, you know, like the Rubios and the Fred or Ted Cruz, those guys. I mean, it was more lesser of the two evil kind of a decisions that people were. It was a strategic decision to vote for those guys. No one was like super excited about Rubio. No one was like cheering for Ted Cruz or anybody. Whereas Trump, I think he really understands media. He really understands propaganda, and he knows the language to use. And he knows not just like the phrasing, but like, you know, how to say it and who to say it to. And it's just, I watched it and I was just like, wow, this guy's going to win. And I went into this. So at this conference, and I can't talk too much about it because of NDAs and stuff like that, but let's just say there was like a round table discussion of all these DC libertarians, and they were discussing the election, and we were supposed to go around the table and make predictions as to who would win. And I was the only one out of like 30 people that said, I think Trump's going to win. It was almost like that Ann Coulter clip when she's on Bill Maher. And she says Donald Trump, and the whole audience laughs. Like, no one in D.C. thought he was going to win. It was they looked at me like I was insane. And after the conference, I had a guy in the from the room come up to me. He's like, I actually think Trump's going to win too, but I was too afraid to say it. So I don't think any of these people in D.C. saw this coming. So I think that's a good thing. I think Trump, like I said, Trump's not entirely negative thing. I think it was a necessary step. And even now, like with this, you know, with this pro-Israel stuff that he's kind of going overboard on. That's, I think, a necessary step too, because it's really getting people to at least question why there's so many goodies being handed out to a foreign country, and to start looking at, you know, the people in his cabinet and the people that have been funding him, and kind of maybe ask some questions they wouldn't have asked otherwise. So I see him as a necessary step, and I suspect he'll win again for the exact same reason, because people are thinking emotionally about Trump. I mean, you'll look at the Trump rallies. There's people literally like in tears, like kind of reminds me of the Obama rallies in 2008, when, you know, people were fainting and stuff like that. That's why Obama won. It's the same reason. It's just any, whatever candidate can get people to think emotionally about stuff, really doesn't matter what he's running on or what he's saying. That's not how influence works. You know, it's whoever's getting the crowd to get emotional about it. And I don't see anyone getting emotional about Warren or about Buttigieg, or I don't know, you know, whatever that guy's name is.
Buttigieg, isn't it?
No, what was it?
Buttigieg, or something like that.
Buttigieg. Yeah, no one can even say his name, but he's not going to win. And then there's, you know, Bernie maybe, but like, you know, Bernie lost a lot of his core support because of Hillary Clinton. A lot of these really hardcore Bernie people actually jumped onto the Trump train when they saw that he sold out his voters when, you know, when it, especially once it came out, any of the intelligent Bernie followers that realized that.
Oh, Bernie apparently, knew, sorry, just to interrupt. Apparently it's pronounced Buttigieg.
Buttigieg?
Yeah.
he's a Buttigieg.
There we go.
See, and that's the other thing, like the first gay serious, I guess you call him serious candidate, openly gay, serious, openly gay, let's put it that way, serious candidate, his name has butt in it, like in the beginning.
That's really unfortunate.
It's so ridiculous. What almost makes you wonder if it's even real, like, but anyway, like no one's emotional about any of these guys, any of these DNC guys. And the only thing that could maybe sink Trump is he's going to have less enthusiasm because of people like me. And he's going to have a slight, but maybe significant demographic shift in states like Texas, Pennsylvania, and some of these Rust Belt states where he just barely kind of held on. You know, there, I mean, we've had more immigration under Trump than we ever did under Obama. So, and what they do, it's not like people keep thinking that, like, you know, these people come from across the border and just hang out in like Southern California and Texas and Arizona. No, like they get on their, we put them on taxpayer funded airplanes and fly them into the interior. I don't know why. Well, I know why, but you know what I mean? Like, I don't know. I don't know how they can with a straight face tell us that this is something they need to do. But so where do you think they're flying them to? You know, we've seen already
areas of the country, I would imagine.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And we've seen that over and over and over again, even if Trump didn't want that to happen. And I don't know that he doesn't seem to be doing anything about it. So I don't know that this is a top priority for him. But even if he didn't want this sort of thing to be going on, as we've seen, the deep state or the permanent state or whatever you want to call it, this bureaucratic nightmare that is our ruling class is like, apparently you can't fire them and restaff them with Trump supporters, or at least Trump didn't. And so they don't seem to always, in fact, they seem to be hindering some of the things he does try to do and want to do. So this is just one of those things.
Do you think one of the main problems is the assumption that's been inculcated everywhere that now that these people are here, they can't possibly leave?
Right.
When
now they can leave. That doesn't
follow at all. You speak on that.
Well, not only can they leave, it's been done before. I mean, people say, oh, you can't, what are you going to do? Load them up on buses? It's like, yeah, like we did that I mean, I can't even say the name of the operation anymore because it's considered hate speech. But just if you Google Operation What Water Makes Things and the Opposite of Front, you'll find
right.
You'll find what I'm looking for. And I mean, that's exactly what we did, is we stuck them on buses and shipped them across the border. And Trump, you know, even before the before the midterms, one of his little dangling goodies that he dangled in front of the voters was, oh, I'm going to go after birthright citizenship. I can, you know, I've been talking to my lawyers. All I got to do is sign this executive order, and you don't have birthright citizenship anymore because we've decided it's not constitutional. That never happened. Like, the midterms came and went, and you know, I think he mentioned it again the other day, like a week ago, like just another, you know, dangling it in front of people, like, oh, and I'm sure he'll save it again. You know, I'm sure we'll hear about it again right before the election, or maybe we won't, you know, depending on what they determine the demographics are. If they, you know, if they do the, if their consultants tell them, yeah, at this point, you're actually going to be hurting, you know, because of the amount of Hispanics now, and because of their, how they're polling on this issue, if you talk, you know, that's the problem, is it's just, they, it's all run by these DC consultants that, first of all, that's the other thing that the Trump election kind of proved too, was all this polling is completely fraudulent. And it's easy to get a poll with the results that you want just by changing a few words around. Again, you're getting the people you're polling to think emotionally about it. So it's easy to tweak the question around and kind of get the result that you want. And people are crazy if they think that there's not a bias with these K Street lobbyist funded consultants in DC, that all they have to do is, if they want to convince the RNC that, oh no, we need to start appealing to Hispanics now because we've already reached the tipping points too late, it's easier for them to generate data that says that. And that's how these people operate. They, you know, you show them the data, the official graph, the, you know, and because these people are so disconnected from the communities that they rule over, they don't know, you know. So if you show them a graph that says most people are now supporting transgender rights, just as an example, the Republicans will start supporting transgender rights, because for them it's about getting elected. It's not about, you know, it's about maintaining power. It's not so much about preserving a culture that they are separate from. You know, the ruling class culture is.
But it's surely, it's not even about getting power, because if they wanted power, as demonstrated in the last few elections, what they would do is appeal to the white vote, but they don't. They very much don't do that, the Republicans.
Well, I think that, you know, in some respects, they're playing the long game, and so they do want power, but they know that you're going to have. I'm trying to think of a YouTube friendly way of putting this. Essentially, if you're in charge of, let's do like a farmer analogy. If you're a farmer and you've got 100 head of cattle, and these cattle, they produce a lot of beef, but a lot of them get away. Sometimes they want to be the farmer. They try to take your job, or they, you know, they stampede and stuff. And then you have these other cattle that are more docile. They might not produce as much, but they cause you fewer problems. And you're offered to buy these cheaper cattle, and you're told that, yeah, you can even breed some of them together and you know, get some hybrids, and you know, who knows what'll happen. I think that's what's going on, is they're farming us. You know, like, this is really, is it really any different than slavery, when you talk about 78% of Americans living paycheck to paycheck, meaning that if they lost their job, if they stopped doing what their boss tells them to do, you know, even for like a couple weeks, I mean, they're out on the street, they can't, I mean, 78% of Americans are living like this. So, I mean, I don't know how that, and then, you know, the mortgage kind of, you know, the way that's set up to where, oh yeah, you can buy a house, but it's going to take, in fact, the word mortgage means death agreement. like in the show, it's you're paying it till you're dead.
Yeah. So it's ominous.
Yeah. It's just, you're paying it for 30. It's a complicated way it's slavery with more freedom, but it's still slavery, right? You're still serving the state. And even with property, you're paying property tax. If you stop paying property tax, the state just confiscates your land. So it's never really yours. Even if you pay it all the way off, you have to keep paying the tax or it reverts back to the state. So it's you're always just kind of an employee of the United States at the end of the day. So because they're the executives, it's in their interest to have the cheapest labor possible that's going to cause the fewest amount of problems and that is going to believe you easier. Like it's easier to trick people that have an IQ of 90, for example, than it is to trick people that have an IQ of 110. And, you know, you're crazy if you think that doesn't go into the equation. So I think there's a lot of that going on. I think that, or at least that's a big part of it, but also, it depends on, you know, cause the ruling class isn't just like this big monolith. It's not just, they all have this one plan that they're all eagerly working towards. There might be some of that going on, but that's just not possible. Different people have different motives. So I think if you look at the left, they look at the way that these new Americans or these migrants or however you want, people that are from other parts of the world, how they vote once they come to the West. And there it's easy math. I mean, if Mexicans voted Republican, we would have had a wall by now. Like Obama would have built the wall, you know, himself, you know, he would have been out there building the wall. And so it's
like, you could just let ordinary Americans build it. I think they would.
Yeah, they absolutely would. I mean, I remember just not that long ago. Oh, here we go. This is for like a 10-year. This is how things have changed. It might have been about 10 years ago. There was a group called the Minutemen. And it was this is how long this has been going on for. Because it got to the point where Americans were like, you know what? You guys aren't even patrolling the border anymore. We're just going to get a bunch of guns and we're going to go to the border and we're going to patrol it for you. And when we find people crossing the border, you know, we're not going to just kill them or stuff like that. We'll call you guys up to come pick them up, but we're going to hold them at gunpoint. And they had, obviously there was some legal issues with doing that, you know, vigilante justice. And they arrested a bunch of these guys and they ended up, the federal agencies ended up busting it up. But just the fact that it got to that point 10 years ago, I mean, cause it must have been, it might have been more than 10 years ago. I mean, this was a long time ago. And the fact that it got to that point just tells you that this is a problem they've never wanted to solve. And you have interests on the right too. I think that you have these libertarian types on the right that they see the voting patterns, but they're not as bothered by that because they also see their balance sheets. They know that if they stopped the flow of immigration, they would make less money because they would have to start, you know, the whole trope of, oh, it's the jobs Americans won't do. And it's like, no, it's jobs Americans won't do for $5 an hour. But if you pay them enough, eventually there'll be people that'll do those jobs. I mean, it wasn't that long ago that you could be a supermarket, you know, clerk, and raise a family, you know, with your wife not working. You know, like these jobs that they say Americans won't do used to be jobs Americans did and were able to support their families with. So you have the interests on the right that are like, well, you know, and I talked a little bit about how I was involved with libertarian nonprofits. One of them was geared specifically towards trying to red pill, you know, well, libertarian pill, I don't know what you'd call that, Hispanic people. And it was abysmal. Like they were throwing so much money at it, trying to, you know, and they'd get so excited every time they got like a relatively articulate Hispanic guy that was woke to libertarianism. They'd get so excited about it. But it was and we're talking, they were spending hundreds of, like, it wasn't just millions, it was like hundreds of millions of dollars across the country with outreach and giving free goodies. And you know, some of it was as like, it's, you know, and then you had people like Glenn Beck giving teddy bears to the people, you know, because you have the people that I think that really believe their own bullshit, that, oh, we're all just individuals, we're all just interchangeable. So clearly all we have to do is educate these new people and show them how awesome libertarianism is, and how awesome, you know, Western liberalism is, and they'll just become just like everyone else. Like, America is just a placeholder for ideas. Like, I think some of them actually believe that. So you have that kind of stuff going on, but you also have a lot of the Christian right, and their generosity and their empathy is so manipulated for a variety of things. But that's what, you know, when you had Glenn Beck doing like a teddy bear drive, like, oh, well, you know, I don't like these mass hordes of people coming across the border, but let's buy them teddy bears, you know, and doing fundraisers. And that was right wing Christian.
This is supposed to be serious adult politics.
Right. Right. No, and he raised, I don't even want to know actually, cause I'm sure there was some embezzlement going on or something like that. Because, you know, I'm sure it was a bunch of made in China teddy bears at a buck a pop that on the books worked out to be like 10 bucks a pop or something like that. But it's frightening. And it's not even just that. Like, I was watching this, documentary where they were talking about all these, I think it was Somali, but they were moving all these people from Somali into Idaho, and it was causing all these problems. And one of the groups that was facilitating it was one of these evangelical Christian groups. They're like, oh, we made care packages for you, and we're going to help you come into our community of only 1,000 people, you know, where you're effectively going to change, you know, overnight the in a meaningful way, the demographics of our town, and add all these people who don't even speak the language, and are not equipped to be any kind of contributors to the society. So come on in, and we're going to give you, and that's the problem, is it's the Christians do have a soft, they, I think it's because we are in decadence right now. And so you have these Christians that have not a guilty conscience, but they feel like, well, if I have all this prosperity in my life, I need to share it with those less fortunate. And they don't realize that in doing so, they are essentially depriving future generations of the same prosperity that they enjoyed. And it's because it's something that, I think the baby boomers were subjected to so much programming because of people like Martin Luther King, you know, the whole civil rights movement. It became such a part of the identity of that generation that we are all the same and there's no difference and race is only skin deep, and we should welcome in everyone and, you know, for any reason into our country, and diversity is our strength and all this stuff. I think it became such a part of their identity that it's impossible in many cases. I mean, so there's some boomers out there that get it, but there's so many that would agree with us probably on almost every other topic that they just can't, you know, you can't teach an old dog new tricks. And
here's a question for you. You said that a lot of money and effort, time went into pushing libertarianism to Hispanics. Mm-hmm. Why didn't it work?
Well, honestly, I think it was an aptitude problem. I mean, we're talking, I mean, there, these people that they were, you know, doing missionary work with, for lack of a better term, you know, like trying to evangelize to these people. I mean, you're basically getting people from DC think tanks with, you know, relatively high IQs, but are also relatively out of touch. They live in the Beltway. They've probably never even interacted, at least certainly not in any kind of significant way, with anyone with an IQ below 100 or, you know, 110 maybe, right? Like they don't even, like when you start talking about the diversity problem with a lot of these people, they genuinely think that you're racist, I think, because they've never had interaction. Like they're never immersed in any kind of diverse environment. So when they go to try to get these people that are coming across, I mean, this isn't true of every one of them that are coming, but if you just look at averages, the averages in, what was it, in Honduras is something like, I'll look it up here actually, so I don't say it wrong, but I think it's like in the 80s, like 85. Average IQ Honduras. It's 81. So, I mean, you have this. Yeah. So you have like these group of people with an average IQ of 81, and you're trying to explain to them in a language, by the way, that's another thing that a lot of people don't seem to get is the Constitution was written in English, and there's a lot of subtleties that you're not going to, I mean, it's so old English at this point. There's a lot of Americans that would have trouble reading it. But that's part of the thing too. So you have all these people that don't even speak the language, who have an average IQ of 81, who don't really have, well, absolutely don't have any genetic connection to the founding or the founders, who might even have contempt for the founding stock, for perceived slights or injustices. So you have these groups of people who are just coming across the border to take advantage of the welfare state and to take advantage of the wealth of the nation. And really that's all they're here for, you know, and you're trying to red pill them on stuff that's hard to even get Americans to pay attention to, you know, like think of how many, the IQ in the West is dropping. And think of how hard it is now. Like anytime you see those men on the street interviews, regardless of who's doing them, it's fascinating that there are so many well-dressed, presumably affluent-looking people that just know so little about the world around them. So to assume that you're going to get these people with an 81 IQ who probably have no education whatsoever or very little education, who don't speak the language, to just magically embrace the Constitution, it's insanity. And here's something actually that I don't think a lot of people think about is if they come here to America, they don't have, like, the way we get our culture, the way I understand America is, my idea of America came from my parents and from my family and, you know, my traditions. And knowing that my family's been on this continent for centuries and knowing the history of my family. And that's how I have arrived at my idea of America. These people don't have any of that. So the only way that they're going to figure out what America is supposed to be about is through media. And what is media telling people that America is, or, you know, you could say academia as well, but it's the same story. What is academia and media telling people whether we're talking about 81 IQ Hondurans that come across the border illegally, or we're talking about maybe a 95 IQ East Indian coming on a visa legally? How are they developing an idea about what America is supposed to be? Because they don't have that background. And so they're the only way they can figure out what America is supposed to be like is by paying attention to the culture that's around them and who controls the culture. The left controls the culture. So it's being defined, not only is the propaganda that's in our media trying to redefine what America is to existing populations, it's the starting point. If you don't know any better, you know, like if you just show up, it's like if I just showed up in Japan, I don't know anything. I know very little about Japan. I'll just be honest. I don't know a whole lot about Japan. And so I would have to just start, you know, I'd watch Japanese TV and movies and listen to Japanese news and radio, and I would form an idea based on that as to, oh, okay, I think I understand Japan a little better. And some of it would be through interactions, but not a whole lot of it because I wouldn't know anyone. And so that's the same thing. If you have these people coming from India or you have these people coming from Honduras, even if they wanted to assimilate, right, they would, I mean, what are they assimilating to? They're assimilating to this manufactured left-wing version of the West that doesn't even exist. So, that's slowly beginning to exist, unfortunately.
Yes.
So it's, in a way, it's like you kind of, I want to give them a little bit of leeway because even if, you know, how would they figure it out? But that's why it's so important that we start. One of the things that I've always noticed, because I've wanted to make movies my whole life. Even when I was a little kid, you know, I watched a lot of Jim Henson movies and Star Wars. I wanted to do special effects and wanted to, make, robotic puppets and all that kind of thing. And then when it turned into 3D animation, I became a 3D animator and was really fascinated by special effects and that kind of storytelling and, the Lord of the Rings movies and stuff like that. And, but one of the things that that's been frustrating is in working in that industry, I had to keep everything I thought about politics, like not just to myself, but it got to the point where I almost I got to the point, which is why I think I had some trouble in some places, but I got to the point where by being quiet, but by not reaffirming what this leftist garb talking points that they were talking about in the room, at the water cooler or whatever, by not agreeing with it openly and reaffirming what they were saying, it's like they knew I was the bad guy, because I wasn't openly proselytizing the same talking points that they were.
That's it. I mean, neutrality isn't enough. Neutrality is assumed to mean opposition. If you don't actively go along with it, then you're probably an enemy, or at least you're damn suspect.
Right. No, perfect example would be if you watch, when Kim Jong-il's dad died and all the Koreans, fake crying in the streets. It's like if you're not crying hard enough for the dead dictator, then you're going to be disappeared. Obviously, it's a watered down version of that, but it's the same sort of thing. It's like if he doesn't say how much he loves gay marriage, then when that topic comes up, then we're not hiring him for the next gig because something's not right about that guy. So but the reason it got to that level is the right has always just kind of ignored culture, and when they have tried to do it, it's I don't know why, but it's like it's so poorly executed usually, and I don't know if it's because they're just I think a lot of it's money, and because so much money goes, just look at the budget for any movie that comes out now, any movie, now even a movie that's considered a low budget movie, it's just millions and millions of dollars, and so that seems like a huge waste to someone on the right. It's like, well, why would I spend all that money on a movie that millions of dollars? Because they think about efficiency and they think about how they would run a business and they want to cut corners. And the problem is when you cut corners on art, it shows. It ends up being porno without the nudity. It's just like bad acting and ridiculous situations and bad writing. And so
I think the right also think, well, why would I want to implant messages in a film where people aren't? I would be catching people unawares. That would be trickery. Right. They don't realize that the left are completely shameless about doing this.
Right. No, and that's the thing is propaganda became a bad word after World War II. I mean, we used to have an Office of Propaganda. That was the name of it in the United States. And I don't see why that should be a bad word. It's just... I think they started to associate propaganda with the USSR and Nazi Germany because that's what accomplished a lot of the goals of those two governments was propaganda, and Americans fancied themselves above all that. Like, we don't need to emotionally appeal to our audiences. We'll win with facts and logic. That's how we'll own the libs.
Yeah.
And it's NPCs don't operate off facts and logic. And if you've allowed women to vote in your country, then facts and logic, you know, sometimes not as important as emotion. That's just the way it is. And so I think
this is a problem that it's with the right. It's also with the centrists now. They also have the same naive idea that if you can be logical with people, then you can get through to them. And I think it's completely mistaken.
Well, right. Like, well, if that was the case, I mean, all you'd have to do if you wanted to date a woman is you could walk up to her and say, you know, I make enough money to support you. I have a nice house and I'm not unattractive and I find you attractive. Let's get married and start having children. I mean, and she would just say yes, because it's a logical, I mean, because after all, we're just robots, right? I mean, that's the problem is anyone, all these people who believe in all these isms, you know, whether it's communism or libertarianism, the assumption is that we're all just robots, that we all are just going to autistically go along with the programming, you know, like with communism would work great if we were just robots, you know, like, oh, well, you know, Jimmy over here needs a new pair of pants. And so he gets a new pair of pants. But the problem is, you know, like, Jimmy might lie about needing a new pair of pants because he really likes pants, or you know, like, humans are flawed creatures and we're unpredictable and we make illogical decisions and we have emotional thinking. So I think that these people at the think tanks and, you know, right wing especially, because I think right wing people just tend to be more or less emotional in their thinking. They don't realize that, oh, that's great, but that's not like there's a whole half of the other half of the country that does base a lot of their decisions on emotion. And, you know, if you want to actually get anything done, you have to appeal to those emotions. And there's nothing wrong. There's nothing nefarious about, I mean, Jesus used parables. Was he emotionally manipulating everybody by telling a story to get a point across? Of course not. Well, or maybe you could say he was, but that's my point is it's not a nefarious bad thing. It's just, it's an effective way of communicating complex ideas to the average person. I mean, that's 100% how Jesus didn't just sit there and try to explain, from an ethical standpoint, why, you know, you should be good to your neighbor or why you should forgive the son that went away and comes back. He just would tell a story that would have emotional, that would reach people on an emotional level. So they would arrive, they would into this complex ethical problem. They would be able to intuit it and have an idea of this big picture idea that he was trying to communicate with a simple little story. And the right never does that. They never do that. And the left only does that. I mean, in fact, that's why the left is so easy to debate. That's why they don't debate us online or elsewhere. And that's why they try to shut us down when we are just giving out facts and stuff, because they can't survive on the ideas. They can only survive on the emotions. So I think that if we want to actually get our vision and make it a reality, we have to first make it fiction that people feel emotionally connected to. And that's just something that's so overlooked. And hopefully maybe that's something in this next decade, since we're talking about kind of how we want things or how we see things changing. Maybe that's something. I mean, I hope it, I don't suspect it'll change that much, because it's something I've been hoping would change my entire life. But then again, there are a few people, writing books and trying to do, you know, comedy and trying to do fiction. And hopefully that's something though, that our movement can focus at least a good portion of energy on, like an appropriate amount of energy on, so that we can, I mean, when else in history we're giving up a wonderful opportunity. There's never been a time in history where you could even make a movie and reach as many people as Hollywood. And you can now. And so it's insane that we're not grabbing this opportunity and using it, because it could pass us by. You know, if we wait too long, I mean, there's the potential there to make I'm just using a movie as an example. It could be anything. You know, this applies to music, books, everything, really. You can make any form of media and get it in front of as many, if not more, people than Hollywood or Simon and Schuster or, I don't know the record company names. So Def Jam. I know that's going to date me. but like, it's easier now for people to do that than it's ever been in history. And this might be a window that's closing really soon. So I think it would be insane to not have our movement focus a lot on culture, especially while we're in this kind of mode right now where we don't have any institutional power anyway. So it's like, if, you know, we could just sit here and debate and we should continue to debate the issues continuously. But at the same time, it's like, as long as we don't have any institutional power, why don't we try to at least reach people on an emotional level?
Well, absolutely. And I think that as long as YouTube allows this kind of stuff, then of course we should be using it. And this has come up in quite a few millennials this year, that we should be trying to communicate at the cultural level rather than go clumsily for straight towards politics when there isn't that cultural grounding to support the politics.
Yeah, I think another reason why there's going to be some difficulty is but the nature of the way our brains work, right? I think that the people that are attracted to the right just tend to not be as, I don't want to say they're not as creative and they're not as imaginative, because that's not the case, but they're not the personality type of a performer. You know, they're not, I mean, there's a reason why like almost every actor is left wing. I think there's a biological reason for that. I think that if you're drawn to that kind of a profession, then you're also, your brain just works the way a leftist brain works. I think there's an actual biological difference there. So I think that's another reason why the right has always struggled. Because when you are in this environment, and even if it wasn't, let's put it this way. Let's say I wanted to make a movie, which I do. I'd love to make a movie version of my book, right? If I wanted to make a movie version of my book and I wrote a script, and even if I got funding for it and, I had like a good, cinematographer and I was like, yeah, this is going to look really slick. Well, the make it or break it for a film, which is why they get paid so much, is actors. And even if you found actors that were like, yeah, I actually agree with you on demographics or whatever, if they were in your movie, they would never work again in Hollywood. So yeah. It's a non-starter. I mean, they wouldn't even audition for it. So even if they wanted to do it, the only way that you could ever actually be successful and do something like this is if you just had like some martyrs, you know, actors that were just like, whatever, I'm going to fall on my sword here and I'm going to be, you know, maybe that's what I'll do. And if you're an actor out there and you're listening, hey, maybe this is something that you could do to help out. But you just focus on, you know, right-wing stuff. 'Cause once you do one, you're never working in Hollywood again. And I think there are certain people that have are maybe thinking about this or have done this. And you can even say Owen Benjamin's an example. You know, he was repped by a big Hollywood agency and it was in movies and television. And all he had to do was say that he thought that having trans kids was child abuse, and he lost his representation, like, 'cause he wouldn't apologize. And now, you know, he's producing his own specials and doing all that because he got completely blacklisted off of any, you know, he couldn't even perform in clubs. I mean, he's performing in his first club since he said that, I think like next year sometime, there's some small Vegas venues letting him in. So it's, you know, you have certain people sticking to their guns and doing that. But I think that to really, and that's important to show people that it can be done. And so if we have people that are actors or that are talented songwriters or performers, that is really important. But if we can actually, I think another thing too, because people have to survive off this stuff, if we can actually make it profitable to where, you know, maybe they're obviously not going to make as much money acting in right-wing films as they would in, you know, some Hollywood film that has $100 million budget. But if we could actually make a cottage industry of producing these kinds of films and music and actual in books and whatnot, to where you could actually afford to pay these actors, so they're not just starving artists. They can actually make a living doing this. And I think that there might even be a level of support out there, the people watching this show. And I've enjoyed a lot of support. It's been really, I mean, I live very frugally but I still am able to survive doing what I'm doing with my book. And by the way, before anyone asks, yes, the second book I was supposed to have done, I said I was going to try to have done by the end of summer, and it just, man, like the amount of stuff I've had to do here at the homestead has been a little intense. So it's very close to done. It's been very close to done for like a couple months, but like, you know, it was important to have hot water and stuff like that. So, but yeah, if we could just make it profitable, I think that would make a huge difference. Just the problem is we don't have like the, you know, the Weinsteins, and we don't have the big money bankrolling these projects. You know, we don't have the ability to drop 100, even if we wanted to, we couldn't make like the nationalist version of Star Wars. You know, it'd be impossible.
Oh, of course. The money involved is massive, but then of course, even if you could make the film, you couldn't have it shown in theaters. And the whole distribution network doesn't exist. You would have to try to persuade, someone's just said, Mel Gibson almost got The Passion of the Christ canned. This is a huge problem. And I don't know I can't really think of anything, any way to combat this. I think the mainstream media is simply not, and not only is the mainstream media off limits to us, but also we cannot hope to operate in the same way. We cannot emulate the mainstream media. It's not going to work.
Right. No, I think that, like, so I think if you're going to make a movie, just as another example, one thing that's also a new thing, it's not just that, you know, we do have these new distribution, like we don't have distribution in theaters, certainly, but we do have distribution online with Vimeo, with YouTube, with BitChute, with, you know, at least for right now, we have the ability. And you can't make the same amount of money, obviously, as you would doing like a first run theater kind of a release. And you won't even reach the same amount of people because you don't have that marketing machine behind you and whatnot. And you can't even make the same kind of movies. But I think it'll just be, these are evolutionary pressures. These are evolutionary pressures that are just going to force us to think outside of the box. I mean, you can make a movie with an iPhone camera. It might not look the best ever, and I wouldn't recommend it. I mean, considering how cheap other cameras are. But the idea that, like, I mean, I've been in video a long time. The first video camera I bought was a digital. It was digital, but it was mini DV. It was like $3,000. It was like a Sony TRV 103 or something like that. I don't know, just total garbage though. You know, I bought that camera and I made my first short film with it. And that actually got me one of my first jobs, because I knew my limitations. I knew, like, okay, all I've got is this stupid Sony Handycam and I've got this really crappy, slow computer. I think I had Vegas Video at the time. And, you know, I had to teach myself how to use that. And, to give an idea how long ago this was, I think when I told you I got my first job, my first real video job with it, I gave it to him on a VHS tape, you know? And so it was a while ago. But you can do that. You know, you can shoot movies with a DSLR. There's some like really cheap 4K cameras now that like have really good picture. Audio is not that expensive anymore. And so the key is
the technology isn't the bottleneck here. I mean, as you say, modern cameras are fantastic. Good audio quality isn't hard to get. The issue is the actors, and not even the studio time, because the studio would have no idea what you were doing, so that's fine. You could rent a studio. The issue is the actors and then distribution.
Yeah, no, I think, but I would say it's the actors more than the distribution, because you could still put it online. Whether or not you could monetize, I don't know how much money you'd make on it. You know, that might be an issue, but I think you'd still make it available to people. And there are, at least in the United States, and I don't know, they might deplatform you as soon as they found out you were doing this. But I worked for a production house that we made a film that we wanted to put in theaters, and we couldn't get it the distribution that we wanted, a deal that wasn't going to just screw us over. But there was a company called, I forget what they're called now, but it doesn't matter. What they would do is, you, and especially for, you know, because we have people all over the world, this would actually work. Again, I think until they figure out you were doing this. But all you had to do is you sign up through this company that would essentially rent out a part of a theater. But then you had better sell, you know, you had to sell X amount of tickets in that area in order for it to be released there. Well, I think that'd be doable. You know, like I think that if we'd have enough people in major cities, certainly, to where, I mean, if I made a film, I feel like just with my YouTube channel, I could probably sell at least enough tickets. I mean, you don't have to sell the whole theater. You just have to sell like 100 tickets or something like that. And I feel like if this was a big thing, that'd be a doable thing. So I think there's options, or you could do film festivals. I mean, we could hold our own film festival. In fact, one thing we could do is have a film festival and then ask people to submit their films. And then we create the venue for the films to be played. And then we don't even have the overhead of having to make all these films ourselves. We leave it up to other people out there that think the way that we do, that probably have talent and cameras. And, you know, not everything that's going to be submitted is going to be a gem. There's probably going to be some, you know, some cringy stuff that gets submitted, but it's never been done before. I would love to see a nationalist film festival. And so I think there's ways you could, at least in some small way, try to get the ball rolling. Book writing, not as many people read books these days, but that's a thing where you don't have to rely on actors. It's actually why I wrote my book, because I didn't have to rely on anyone aside from myself, because you just have to write it. You know, you upload it to in the right format and everything, and then, you know, you're away you go. And that's also a first time in history. You don't have to go through any publisher. You don't have to self-publish and then buy like 1,000 copies and then try to mail order sell them, or, you know, whatever. So it's very low risk when you write a book. But the audience isn't going to be there the same as it would be for a movie. I don't know. I would love to see, or even animation. You could say, if you don't, another thing, if you don't want to show your face, if you don't want to be an actor, you could be a voice actor. I mean, that would be another option. And animation is another thing that's gotten a lot cheaper. And as South Park has proven, it doesn't have to be the most high-tech, crazy animation ever for people to enjoy it. If the writing's good, if the stories are good, the voice acting is reasonable. It could even be part of the style of the cartoon that it's kind of shitty, you know, like South Park. It's just construction paper.
Yeah, or Murdoch, of course.
Right. No, Murdoch, that's a good example. That Murdoch, I think, has done a fantastic job of doing exactly that, where they've just said, you know what, we're just going to make our own stuff. You know, we're going to make this really kind of shitty animation and focus more on the storytelling, and I think they've been really successful in that, especially for being as deplatformed as they are. They still get enough people watching it to where, if, I don't know if you've ever tried to watch it right as it gets announced on their YouTube channel on that Cheeky Videos or whatever site, but it gets you know, it's almost impossible to even watch it because it's, there's so many people, so much demand for it. And that, the other frustrating thing, I can see how they'd be so frustrated because of the way it's being released, you don't even know who ends up, how many people end up watching it. You know, you don't get the feedback or anything like that. That's got to be kind of devastating.
I think they know that they do have an audience, and that's why they keep doing it. Okay, shall we move on to Super Chats, and then we'll wrap this one up.
Absolutely.
Happy New Year to you both. Question for Devin. Who is the most subversive filmmaker who isn't a member of the tribe?
I would say... I'm going to sound like an idiot for not knowing his name. Pulp Fiction guy.
Quentin Tarantino, yeah.
Yeah, Tarantino. Absolutely. I would say him, no, like 100% Tarantino. I mean, just think of all the degeneracy and awfulness he has normalized. And his whole shtick, you know, especially with Pulp Fiction, the whole idea behind that was getting people to cheer for awful people. Like he said that in an interview, like his whole goal was to get people to root for terrible people. And so that's something you'll see again and again and again in all of his movies. Maybe not all of them, but most of his movies, the good guys, quote unquote, are just awful people. And he's doing that on purpose.
Yeah. And there's a lot of anti-white sentiment in his films. Not in his 90s films, but definitely nowadays. I can hardly bear to, and each time another Tarantino film is announced, I dread to find out what it's about.
Yeah.
Okay. Devin, would you direct a film if we crowdfunded it, and how much money would it take?
It would depend. I mean, as far as how much money it would take, it would wildly vary based on the script. Because if you had a movie, and people have done this, there was a movie in the I want to say like the early 2000s or late 90s called like Phone Booth or something. And they shot the entire movie, and it was part of the marketing was New York was getting rid of all their phone booths because, you know, everyone had cell phones, and it was the last phone booth that they, before they were going to get rid of it, they were going to shoot this film in it. And the whole movie is shot inside of a phone booth. And so that movie, for example, wouldn't really cost that much. Or Castaway, you know, you've got, obviously there was the special effects, you could say, of like the plane crash and stuff at the very beginning, but the rest of it's just Tom Hanks on a beach somewhere. So that would be relatively cheap. So there's creative ways. It depends on, so you almost, a lot of people do this when you write your script, you just have to keep that in mind. Like, what can I afford? You know, how can we be creative? Or like a zombie apocalypse film, you could easily, or another one. What was that one? Blair Witch, where they just went into the forest with shitty cameras, and so they essentially made a movie while they were camping. You know,
yeah, it's amazing. I think someone said the budget for that was 100K, but I don't think it was anything like that. I think it was like 20K.
Yeah, I mean, I'd be surprised if it was 100K. There might be marketing cost or something like that, or you know, maybe they paid themselves very well. I don't know. What I know, Paranormal Activity, which is a similar kind of a thing, a found footage style film, they made a shitload of money, but I think their budget had to have been under 50 grand. He shot it all in his own house with just cameras he had. Now there's ways of doing it really cheap. But again, what I directed, I absolutely would. The crowdfunding, honestly, wouldn't even need to be that much. It would be more, we'd need to find an actor. We'd need to find either a sympathetic actor who is maybe sort of well-known but retired now. Like, I think that might be a good strategy. Find someone who doesn't really care if they never work again in Hollywood, or someone who is young or maybe someone that doesn't even want to act professionally, but they just happen to be good. And there'd be ways of finding someone like that. You could have people submit audition tapes and stuff like that. Or you could even write a movie around, like a lot of people do this too. A lot of times they're like, you know what? we would make a lot of money if we had another Brad Pitt movie. So they just write a movie for him. You know, they'll write a script to play to the strengths of whatever star they're trying to make money on, their acting ability. And so you could do that. If we had an actor that we knew of, that we knew could pull off, like maybe their range wasn't really great, but they can be this kind of a person like really well. You could write something that would fit that. And, you know, you could easily accomplish that. And I've got all the equipment and everything already. And I've worked in the business long enough to where I know people that would maybe loan out studio space and stuff like that if we needed it. So the biggest hang up would be the actors. I think you're muted.
Yes, sorry about that. Yeah, as I said earlier, that is obviously because they could just destroy their careers by taking part in this. All right. Okay. In the future, no, I'm not going to read that one out. Sorry. What is your favorite movie and director?
It's changed so many times just because when I was young, I would have said The Dark Crystal, and I really love Jim Henson. I love the Jim Henson stuff. And I would say some of it still aged pretty well. Like, I haven't seen Dark Crystal in a long time, but I bet it's not. I mean, they're doing a series based on it. I haven't seen that either. But I would imagine it's not considered corny if they're still trying to milk it. That was my big dream. I always wanted to meet Jim Henson, and then he died of the flu or possibly AIDS. It depends on who you believe.
Mm.
I would say that was before. Now I don't even know, but I'll just stick with Jim Henson.
Okay. Considering China holds so much sway over our entertainment industry, would it be worthwhile to employ targeted mimetic warfare with the aim of banning certain Western brands in China?
Yeah, what they're saying is to make fake, like, let's say you want to get Nike banned in China, you would make memes that would impersonate Nike saying anti-China stuff, or is that what they're getting at?
I think so, yeah.
Here's the thing. We have the United States government has the CIA that does this sort of a thing. We don't have any kind of organization. We have a they have the Central Intelligence Agency. We have the DIA, the Decentralized Intelligence, or also known as POL. And so I think, that's certainly worth trying. Whether it would work or not, I doubt it, just because eventually, I mean, it's not like they couldn't call up Nike and be like, did you make this? No? Okay. I think a better way to do it would be to shame, like somehow get the companies to do it. But even then, they would just fire the CEO. I mean, if somehow something happened, and then, when it comes to money, they're not going to, I mean, China likes money just as much as these companies. So if they have a deal there, I think it'd be really hard to engineer what they're talking about.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm not quite sure what the question was getting. I'm sorry about that. To the questioner, I won't read out his name. Why don't people strive to be free or to purge evil among our leaders anymore? Nationalism is romanticism. How do we sell a system that needs us to accept austerity? Do we really just want to be Amish?
Well, there's been a lot of people talking about, do we disengage and go out into the, in my case, middle of the desert in a bunker and try to preserve our culture on a individual level? Make sure that you homeschool your kids, make sure you transmit your culture and protect your children from this subversive culture. Or do you try to stay in the thick of things, in the city and fight them in their ivory towers? I think it has to be both. I think that because we don't have any institutional power, though, because one of the key things we talk about the most is just, our birth rates are down, our population is being replaced. So the easiest way to address that is to make more people, you know, and to not make more people, just make more people, but to make more good people and make people that are not going to be poisoned by a communist academia or by subversive television and movies and stuff. You know, raise your kids to be red-pilled right off the bat. Show them the subversiveness of explain to them why, you know, you don't let them watch certain shows. I think that it worked on me to some extent. I mean, I've always been somewhat right-wing. And I think a lot of that was, and as much as I hated it when I was, I hated it when I was a kid. My mom wouldn't let me watch rated R movies. You know, she wouldn't even let me watch like The Simpsons, and some of it was a little ridiculous, like how much she would hold back, but she wouldn't let me participate in what all the cool kids were doing. And she would replace that with, part of, you know, our culture, which was, the Christian aspects of our culture. She involved me in like our local church had like a youth thing that I had to go to like every week. And yeah, I say had to, cause I didn't always want to go. But in retrospect, I feel like, cause I kind of went off the rails anyway. Like by that, I mean, like I partied way too much in my teenage years and in my 20s, I drank way too much and smoked a lot of pot and was just like a complete degenerate. But I feel like if I hadn't had that, cause even when I was doing all that stuff, I mean, I drew the line at somewhere. Like I would give you an example. I was at parties where, you know, I'm smoking pot, sure, but there's like heroin going on at the party. And I was like, I'm not doing heroin. I have to draw a line. And I feel like if I didn't have that culture transmitted to me and my mom hovering over to me to some extent in my head, I might have been the guy doing heroin. And so, I don't know. I feel like you have to make, if you're worried about being replaced and you're worried about the future of our people, then you have to play a part in that. You have to make more people and you have to make them able to withstand what's going to happen. I mean, because one thing, we don't agree on everything, but one thing I think everyone agrees on is, it's going to get worse to some extent, you know, like there's culturally, certainly it's not going to just stop at trans kids. They're going to keep pushing it. And so you need to make sure your children are able to withstand that. So I don't know if that answers the question. I hope it does.
Yes, it does. Okay. I'll move on to the final question, which is, do you have any white pills to look forward to in 2020?
Yeah, I would say, because here's the thing, like a lot of people, I think they get the wrong impression when I name my channel Black Pilled, they think that what I'm saying is, oh, there's no hope. You know, they mistake it for nihilism, and which is the opposite of what I was just talking about. Right. I'm not saying that there's no hope. I know we're going to win. In fact, it's just that we're not going to win using the existing system. Like when I named it Blackpilled, I was saying Trump's not going to be the one that does it. You know, like voting for Republicans isn't going to do it. I was blackpilled on the system that has failed us over and over and over and over again. I'm not blackpilled on our people. Our people have been responsible for pretty much the greatest things or everything. Look around you, everything, most things that make your life easy just on a day-to-day basis were invented by our people. You know, like whether you're talking about a washing machine when you're washing your clothes, the car you're driving, the technology we're using right now to talk to each other, the smartphone, the regular phone, solar power. I mean, you name it, all this innovation, all this creativity, it wasn't just some happy accident, just like it wasn't some happy accident that our cultures you know, a lot of people say, well, you know, it's you got to think of it this way. So many people are missing this. They say, oh, well, you know, you can't just bring in people from out of the country and they won't assimilate. You know, part of what makes us great is, you know, the people themselves. Okay, well then believe that. Believe that we're going to get through this. I mean, if we are so great, which I agree with, then believe that we're going to make it through it. I mean, I think that for whatever reason, and I don't know if this is just limited to us or just most humans, that we're in a unique position. I can't think of any. It's not like Saudi Arabia is being flooded by Mexicans or something like that. You know, we're kind of in a unique position, so we don't have anything to compare to. But I kind of feel like, you know, as frustrated as we get at our fellow countrymen for not responding in the same way that we are, I think that it's just human nature, especially in a high trust society, to wait until you're kind of on the brink. You know, like you almost have to, because think about, you know, when you procrastinate, sometimes you wait until like, well, if I don't do it now, it's never getting done. And then what happens? You go right into go get them mode and you get it done. It gets done. And I feel like that's maybe what's going on, is just it. And the reason why so many people think it has to get worse before it gets better isn't because they're itching. They have itchy trigger fingers or anything like that. It's because I think that's just part of the process. You just have to get to a point where it shatters the illusion, you know, that comic, that meme where everything's fine and there's all this fire. Like the fire has to start burning you for you to snap out of the illusion and be like, okay, I guess something has to be. Not for all of us, clearly. Like those of us listening, we've been aware of this, some of us, for a long time, and that's what drives us so crazy about it. But, you know, the average person, it's going to take them a little, it might take them, they haven't had to pay any personal costs, maybe. And maybe they have to pay a personal cost. And what, you know, whether that's they lose their job to an immigrant, or their son is hit by a drunk illegal immigrant and dies, or, you know, there's that. I think a lot of people have to pay a personal cost before they go against the official narrative. So the white pill is, we'll get through it.
Okay, excellent. Well, let's leave it at that. This was Black Pilled. I'm back soon with the after party, and then I'll be on with Nightmares. So, okay, let's leave it there. Blackpill, thank you very much for taking part in Millennial 2019.
All right, well, thanks for having me, and to everybody, Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year.
Okay, see you later, and I'll be back in about half an hour with the after party. Thank you, Blackpill.